Hey, welcome everybody. Happy Friday, and welcome to another episode of Make Me Like This. I'm Brandon. This is Jeff. Different sides here. Boom, 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 boom. Always content for the audio listeners on Spotify.
I can't do it. There we go.
That's all right. Hey, it is Friday. Work is over. For me, it's over for the year, so I have a devil may care attitude, man. But not towards this. This topic is something I'm very passionate about, and Jeff is very passionate about, because, and we've talked about this in a previous episode where we said, make me like Will Smith as a rapper. And now we're talking about Will Smith's book titled Will. We both read it. I did the audiobook version. Did you do the same? Did you listen to it or did you read it?
I listened to it.
I'm a little angry because you called my attention to the fact that, oh, if you've never had Audible before, you can get a free trial and get a free book. And I was like, oh, great, I'll do that, and I can experience the Will Smith book I'm really interested in at the price of free. And I did it, and then a couple of days ago, I got an email saying, hey, your next month's subscription to Audible has been run through your credit card. Enjoy month. And I forgot to cancel it.
Anyway, sorry about that.
Yeah, that's all right. You know what? I'll get another book, and I'll get two books for $15. Not a big deal. Just throwing that paper around.
The trick there is whenever I get an Audible book, I subscribe because it's cheaper to do a monthly subscription and get a credit than it is to buy a book outright. And then I use the credit, and then I immediately cancel. Like right then, I immediately cancel. I should have wrote down the notes exactly and then mailed them to you.
That's all right.
I had a napkin and a Sharpie available.
Saving my money. Yeah.
My mom used to write notes to me in my lunch on napkins with Sharpie growing up.
Ooh.
And I distinctly remember I would always open them up and see how many dots like bled through, because it was a Sharpie, right?
Yeah.
So it was always a thing for me to see, like, was she heavy-handed today? And it like made a replica on the next page, or was it just a couple Morse code dots?
Pay no mind to the thoughtful, caring message that your mother sent you as you traversed your day. You don't care. You just like, how much pressure did she put on the pen as she was writing this note? That's okay. We don't all love our mothers, but hey, it's all right.
Yeah, I don't love my mother. I just want to, I'm just an anthropologist.
That's all right. No, Jeff loves his mother. I've met her. Anyway, Jeff, we're going to be talking about the book Will Smith's autobiography, and you had some thoughts that you wanted to share to kind of set a framework for how we discuss this. Is that right?
Yeah, I have three themes that I think stood out to me the most in the book Will.
Yeah.
I'll read off the three themes to start us off with, and I'll let you pick where we go first. How about that?
Yeah.
So the three themes you have to choose from: linguistic and non-linguistic communication, starting off sexy, and then fluid versus rigid values. Apparently I want to make everything a conflict, except for this last one, flow. So again, linguistic and non-linguistic communication, fluid versus rigid values, and flow. Those are three themes. Which theme do you want to explore first?
I want to start with flow, because I think it's like the lightest.
Okay.
Start with that, and we'll go in the others. And then we'll flow into the next one.
Absolutely. We're starting this one off great with our segues. So
Right on.
the story that I want to use to frame flow is Will talks about he was recording, I forget which number album was it, their third or fourth studio album in Chicago. And
Yeah, it was the third one, Home Base.
home base,
Yeah.
right? So they're recording their home base, their third studio album in Chicago. They have a great session. At this point in their career, they're more businesslike than they ever were, because Will's both of them are doing Fresh Prince, but Will is turning into what Will would become, which is this this TV and movie star. And their focus is much more businesslike, which is
Well,
interesting. Yeah, go
right,
ahead.
and coming off of the second album, which was a huge flop, and I think if I'm remembering correctly, it was the one with I think I can beat Mike Tyson. I forget the name of the album, but they spent a lot of time partying with the money from the record company in the Bahamas, was it?
Right.
And not a lot of time spent focusing on the music, and admittedly, it wasn't a good album. Admittedly, by Will in the autobiography, and I think as they looked toward this third album, really taking a business approach to it, taking it very seriously, and having that success of the Fresh Prince, and saying, okay, we've been catapulted now through the
Yeah.
television show and everything like that, so we really have to take advantage of this opportunity and take it very seriously. So.
That's a good reminder for me. Like, yes, the second studio album where they were just effing around, and Daddy-O comes through and like puts the fear of God in both of them as well, which is a great, like, to have your dad show up in the Bahamas. That when you're half naked with girls on your lap, like that's a pretty that's nails on a chalkboard. That's
It's a
the
wake up.
record skipping, right?
And Daddy-O is the affectionate term that he and his family used to refer to his dad. So when he says Daddy-O, that's his dad.
Yeah. So I think something else here too is just, they had less time to devote to that. They were no longer in the like artistic mindset. That definitely, I think, is the backbone, what you set up of like lessons learned. They got burnt and they took an opposite approach. But they didn't have any pressure to make, they didn't need this album. Because Fresh Prince and they were getting their revenue from elsewhere. And I recall Will saying that they'd show up in the studio, do their thing, and it was for them, right? But the thing, how this attaches to the theme of flow is they wrap up the studio sessions, and at the end, I think it's a producer, because it wasn't Jeff that passed him this, but like a producer passed him a CD with Untitled written on it. And it turns out to be the instrumental for Summertime that is just a classic hip hop record, but just a classic summertime vibe as well, right? Samples Summer Madness, and is really like, I would say is, you don't count the Will Smith single or like the Will Smith solo stuff for this. But when you're talking like DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, to me, Summertime it is their best song, period.
That's the most classic of them, in terms of standing the test of time, for sure.
Right,
And
definitely.
most probably most popular and critically acclaimed of the under the moniker DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince.
And he, so Will takes the CD, mm-hmm. doesn't know what it is yet, heads to the airport, about to get on a flight. And he's like, I'll pop this in. He pops it in and just hits him.
Yeah.
And he starts writing. And he writes essentially Summertime from start to finish. Like not in fits and starts, not over several sessions. Sits down and writes it bar by bar in order, pretty much throughout to the end. So just flows out of him. Mm-hmm. Then he gets to then he just makes the choice. He doesn't get on the plane. He goes back to the studio because he's got to record it right then while he's got he's in the groove, right? Right. He needs to continue to get it out of him. And he ends up changing his cadence, his style. He can't deliver it how he would normally lay down a record at that point in his career. And because his voice is wrecked. He just got done with a sprint of a recording session. And so the people in the studio with him say, hey, just like do it laid back. And he ends up channeling, like he calls out that he channeled Rakim, who's like mm-hmm. one of his favorite artists. And he ends up delivering with that. And that laid back vibe along with the, with the instrumental, which is totally laid back and
right.
and big and airy. It ends up being the perfect vibe for that record. So the lyrics flow out of them, and then serendipitously, because of limitations and not like trying to like work again, like not trying to rise above them, but to just get in the pocket within them, ends up making this beautiful masterpiece that in all reality took a day.
Right.
I don't know how long Jeff like was tracking that out with the, you know, to produce the that version of that instrumental from sample and drums and everything like that.
Yeah.
But Will's part from conception to on wax is within a day. A couple notes I have on that is that just like it got me thinking about Rakim in particular when he invokes that, and I had
think we lost you. Oh wait, hold on, there he is.
I'm back. I got booted.
It was a quick boot.
The timing. It's like this guy needs to go. So
it was
so
the hook at the Apollo.
Yeah. I had never associated that record with being terribly abnormal compared to, especially compared to what you'd hear from like on Big Willie Style. Or these later solo albums where Will Smith's cadence is slower, more like laid deliberate. Back and just kind of methodical and rolling. Mm-hmm. Whereas his it did make me think that his Fresh Prince stuff is like a higher register, a little bit like I don't mean to be derogatory. It's a little more whiny. It's mm-hmm. a little more conversational type rap than it is like mid-90s to early 2000s, like that brand.
Sure.
This might represent a pivot point. I mean, it's in that era where the era itself would influence it. But it was interesting for me to think that like, yes, this stylistically marked a departure from the earlier Fresh Prince stuff. But like to speak to Rakim a little bit, Rakim's like the brilliance of Rakim is his cadence is like confident, is like silky smooth, and he hits syllables perfectly on every bar. Like his spacing and his multi syllable rhyme schemes for that time in the 80s is like pioneer work for like what the golden era, and then into just, you know, even up to today, you can find evidence in like Pusha T is very has a lot of legacy of Rakim in his style, just methodical, steady, even, precise, like, but yet floats through. You never hear like Pusha T fight a beat. You never hear Rakim fight a beat. And that's what you're hearing with Will Smith here too, where it's not always the case. Like I've heard Will Smith fight a beat before.
Sure.
I
Yeah.
on this audiobook at the end, the song where he's very much like that, where he's fighting it.
Yeah.
But that was cool, like to hear him talk about that. But this is so that's the story. What I'm wondering is, do you have experience with flow, and do you have like any stories you might share about moments of flow in your life?
Personally?
Yeah.
Oh man. Well, first to allow me
Yeah.
some space to think about that.
Yeah, go ahead.
as it pertains to flow and Will Smith and his career, as he says in the book, that was probably the point, the point that you're identifying with, Summertime, is the transition from the Fresh Prince to Will Smith, right? Because after that was Will Smith, Big Willie style, as Will Smith, not DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. That was his solo thing, right? It was also the time at which he started out on the show with no acting experience. He's just a rapper that they brought in who filled this role of, this fish out of water, from the hood to Hollywood, I think they called it, right? That when Benny Medina was pitching his Benny Medina is the producer of the show, who went from, I think it was Compton, to live with a family in Beverly Hills. And this was his kind of his story. And then he pitched it to Quincy Jones, and Quincy Jones became aware of Will Smith and put him in this role. And that's how that kind of synthesized. But no acting experience. But as he talks about how he masters his craft, whatever craft that is, his methodical nature of almost obsessively chasing that perfection from rapper to TV star, then to movie star, then to superstar, like the biggest star in the world. That's what he said. I want to be the biggest star in the world. And that dedication to it that he talks about, that was instilled in him from Daddy-O at a young age, building that wall, or with when it comes to school, when it comes to his responsibilities, that concept of find something, master it, then before that thing is done, figure out what that next thing is. And then get into that full speed ahead, master that, which I think allowed him to flow from broke rapper to TV star to movie star to international superstar. Have I ever felt that? I think there are times where I'm, creating. I enjoy content creation, whether it's, acting in the past. Creating videos, writing. I think that I will procrastinate and procrastinate and procrastinate. And my producing partner that I would work on those projects with, he would say, "Hey man, before Christmas, we got to have this script written out." And then he'll check in with me, "Hey, it's Thanksgiving. Have you started yet?" I'm getting around to it. I'm getting around to it and stuff. And then at the very last moment, that last weekend before it's due, I turn everything off and I just go boom, 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 and totally focus on getting it done. And I can do that. And I think that the time that I spend in that last 48 hours before something is due, and due is a relative term here, right? Because there's no one with a $1 million check saying, "Hey, you got to turn this in before this date, otherwise this check goes away." I think he knew that I need an arbitrary deadline so that I can get into that mode. But when I'm there, it just happens, you know, and I lay it all out, flesh it out, go back over it, fix some things. And that's the closest I can get to that flow. But for me, it's got to have an additional pressure of time. You're running out of time, so your attention has to be like condensed to really focus on that. And it might take me an additional pressure to do that, but it almost forces me to get into that flow because I have to, otherwise it's not going to get done, you know? So I think that's probably the closest I can come to flow as it pertains to, you know, to creativity or something like that. And I'm not sure, like, when you're working on music, is that what happens for you? You get into flow, you need a steady block of time that's uninterrupted that you can just spend on it and get there?
I think now especially constraints are really helpful. Because the more that you've got, the more responsibilities you've got in life, the more you need to put constraints into place that will allow you to make the time. Because otherwise, all those other responsibilities create their own implicit constraints that constrain you from ever getting there. Yeah. So absolutely, in order to get to like an artistic flow state, I've gotta have
boiler kicked on.
You gotta have a hot pocket.
Gotta have a hot pocket.
Gotta have a hot pocket to get into that flow.
I think that so to your point, I think they're on the surface, you might think that constraints are inhibitive to flow. Because like, I think when I think of flow, I think of like lightning striking you and you don't necessarily know when it's going to come. And so like, as an example to your question, I will make time every Friday night to listen to instrumentals that my buddy sends over to me in packages.
Yeah.
And especially if I get a new package during the week, I'll hold off listening and I'll listen to it on Friday nights. Lightning doesn't strike every Friday night, but there has been, and actually flow hits me a lot less with music under that model, because if I'm not on, then I'm not on. What it ends up being a lot is I segment it. And then I just kind of it ends up being like work. I punch a clock. I get in.
Yeah.
This week I worked on, I usually mumble and try to work out cadences when I'm listening to instrumentals. And I also like to let it like speak to me of like, what's the theme here and what's going on in my life? Like, cause I'll be workshopping stuff in my head right now. I want to write something about a relationship that I know that the moment that I realize that it's ending. And I actually had like that thought in my head before I listened to this book. And then he has like that setting of concrete, like he's aware that in this moment, his relationship with his first wife is over. And he's moving on. But I'll be workshopping those things in my mind, but it's got it. So it's more like, I don't know, it's more like putting a puzzle together for me nowadays.
Yeah.
When I was younger, and I think I've reached flow a lot more often. Like I remember this one time, when I was in college, and I remember it vividly. I heard an instrumental for the first time, and I knew that this song needed to be about it needed to be about the personification of the plain Enola Gay as a mother. And Enola Gay, for if you're not aware, is the plane that dropped an atomic bomb over Japan.
And, oh, okay, okay.
And so, like, and I wrote that song from start to finish and recorded it in it. Like when I listen now, I am not Will Smith, and this song is not on the level of a professional musician. Mm. But I immediately thought of that moment in my dorm room. And I had Applejacks, an open thing of Applejacks that was on my desk that was slightly stale because it had been there for a little bit. But it was the closest thing to eat, so I kept throwing those things in. Like I can remember what my room smelled like slightly musty, but yeah, like a breeze coming from outside because it was springtime. And so I could smell the spring. I can remember what the carpet felt like on my feet, because I was barefoot at a desk writing this. But it all came together in like 4 or 5 hours. And I think it's among like the songs that that I'll go back and I'll listen to the most, especially like my older stuff. I tend to not like it as much. But yeah, but like I've had that moment where just inspiration hits, and that's probably the most pronounced of like the most memorable.
Yeah.
But for me, I'll be sitting at work and I'll have my to-do list, and increasingly like I am more task oriented and have a vision for what my day is going to be like than I've ever been. But when that voice in my head, like that idea speaks to me and I can just drop everything and listen to it, I can get into those things. I've been in situations professionally this week where it's like, oh, that should be a thing. Let me just write, and I'll write 9 pages, and it'll come out of me. But
it's really, so it's really about, it. Yeah, it's really about, riding the wave of inspiration and taking advantage of that when you can, because you can't control when inspiration is going to hit you. And when it does, you better grab onto it and buckle up, you know, and use it until it's gone, because that is a driving force that is going to get you, to completion. And that's, gotta take advantage of it.
It's a great way to describe it, is that it starts with an idea, and I think, like, for me, that's a voice. Like I have voices speaking to me in my brain, but it's like your ability to just drop everything and listen to it, and follow it and see where it goes is how you can get there. And I also think, like, I've been in a flow state before and I'm like, oh man, I'm in a flow state. And then I was out of it pretty quickly thereafter. Yeah.
It's like a no hitter. You don't want to say like, he's about to have a no hitter, and it's going to jinx it, and it's going to come crashing down. So we talked about flow. What was that second thing that you said? The second
you kind of hinted topic at it too when you were talking about always he got burnt, right? What was it? His it was an early relationship, right? where he it ended badly, and he let it go on too long, past the point of where it was still good, and from that point on, he locked in his head that everything must come to an end, and I'm always going to have the next thing lined up. I'm never going to be in this situation again where it gets past ripe, and I don't have the next thing lined up.
Yeah, and this was the girlfriend where he was rapping. He had made some money. He bought a place of his own in Philly, and he was basically living with this woman. They were partying a lot. They started to hate each other, but neither one of them wanted to end it. And it sort of ended when he moved out to LA to start the Fresh Prince. Is that the relationship you're referring to, I think?
Yeah. And this kind of behavior comes up with him frequently. Like, I think it's one of his most fundamentally defining traits, is that he's his through lines are just different than I think that I don't know that it's necessarily different from me or different from the average person, but it's I found it interesting. He breaks through with music. Right, his relationship with Jeff is the first stepping stone in his life that takes him because it happens when he's in high school, right?
Right,
and it takes him into the first level of his entertainment career, and from that point on, he's a professional entertainer. Sometimes broke and out of a job entertainer, but that's his gig. He didn't really have a job other than that, except for, you know, helping out with his dad's company. But when the Quincy Jones thing happens, when Fresh Prince of Bel-Air becomes a thing, and he's going to become a TV star and eventually a movie star. Those are the things that he's lining up. Jeff is not that way.
Right.
Jeff is motivated by making music. He's an artist, and he's still to this day is still largely defined, at least in my mind, by being a musician. And his relationship with Will is at a great intersection of different things. Will is on an entertainment, like he wants to entertain people. Like he wants the stage. He wants to have that impact with people. His vehicle to get him there is fluid. Jeff's is very defined. Yeah. And it even takes like some manipulation on Will's part to get him to be jazz in Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, right? And then the other thing too is like the way that he seeks feedback, the way that he's thinking about the next step. He becomes a movie star, right? He is, and he finds himself in a room with Tom Hanks. I know Arnold Schwarzenegger's there.
Schwarzenegger, Stallone, and Bruce Willis were the proprietors of the Planet Hollywood franchise, the restaurant chain. Yeah, yeah. And those three, at that time, I think this was like late 90s, right? Biggest stars in the world. And he, a person who has appeared on television and in movies, was saying, okay, well, how do I get to that? How do I be one of those guys over there? And asks him, and I think that's when Arnold said to him what he said, which was, I've already forgot. I know it sounded like this. Well, the thing is, you have to look at it like this. How do you do it?
I don't know. I'm from Austria. How do I do it?
Okay, work in, you have to be successful internationally.
Oh, yes. It's fine to be a movie star in the United States, but there's the entire world out there that you also have money. They give you money to come do that. So you have to, when you have a movie produced, you go to China, you go to Germany, you go to France, and you do your interviews, and if they like you, you have all the power. I don't know what he said, but it was something like that, probably. But it's true, right?
It is true, and he's a worker, right? He's got to be busy, and he's got to be putting in effort to succeed. I think he's the quintessential achiever.
Well, almost to a fault, right? Because it's at the detriment of everything else in his life. I am going to be the best actor I can possibly be. And I think one of the stories he tells is in his first marriage, in hiatus between the first season of Fresh Prince and the next, he did this movie with Stockard Channing and creepy looking guy that I can't remember his name. But it's called Six Degrees of Separation. He played like a con man who, you know, got this couple to fall in love with him. And he, you know, he conned them. And he embodied this character so much. This, you know, this was a depressed character. There was so much about him that was flawed. And he brought that with him into his life, his personal life. And so, you know, he would come home and his wife would say, like, hey, what do you want to do? And he didn't want to do anything because he was just like so drained from playing this character and embodying this character. He's like, he said he fell in love with the woman who was playing the person who he wanted to fall in love with in the story in real life. Because he went so deep into that character and it affected him. So, like, his obsessive need to be the best at everything, A, it's worked for him, right? Because he became the biggest star in the world, one of the biggest stars in the world. But at a cost, you know, a cost of his marriage, cost at a relationship with his kids, cost at, you know, friendship, like childhood friendships that dissolved and stuff. There's a real cost to that. So it's so interesting because on one hand, you look at someone like him and you think, gosh, I wish I was like that. Gosh, I wish I had all of that. But I think you see like a thread through his life, like nothing is ever good enough. There's a real sense of loneliness in that, right? Because there's just you and your craft and not a lot else, right? I felt... Throughout the different chapters of the book, I felt sad for him. I felt lonely. Mm-hmm. I felt depressed for him because you have got a hit show on TV and you're not happy. You've got more money than you could have ever imagined and you're not happy. You've got your dream partner, the woman of your dreams in Jada when that finally happened, and he wasn't happy, right? Yeah. That's a sobering thought because, you know, you and I can sit as non-famous people who work a 9-to-5 job and think, oh my gosh, if I had $10 million, I wouldn't feel stressed. I would feel, you know, I would be, you know, doing this and that and I'd be good. But, and even, you know, this is something that is reflected often in the Dax Shepard podcast, Armchair Expert, where he says, you know what? I thought if I was famous, I was rich, and I was rich, famous, and whatever the other thing was, then I would be perfectly happy. And he got all those things and he was miserable. And it's just like, it's not a magic bullet. Like if once you achieve that thing that you're like striving for, what's next, right? That's why he always has to, before he gets to that point with that thing, he's got to bail and he's got to jump onto that next thing, whether it's a book, whether it's an album, whether it's a movie, whether it's a TV show, he's got to be jumping to that next thing. It's crazy. I don't, Did you watch the 6-part YouTube series that he just put out right before the release of this book, The Best Shape of My Life?
I haven't. I just watched Welcome to Earth, the Nat Geo.
Welcome to Earth. Thing. Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty good too. I'm gonna have to check out Best Shape of My Life.
Yeah,
it would be such an interesting, like, I don't always agree.
Yeah.
With him, but a person who's obsessed with entertaining people is very good at entertaining me. I can say that up front. He's very, very entertaining and interesting, I think.
Yeah. But you see the sadness behind that, right? When you put everything out there for every single person that you come in contact with, and this is something that you know, I've read about Robin Williams with Jim Carrey, a lot of people who are Chris Farley, who are in that space of just a consummate entertainer, a constant entertainer, wanting to give that performance to everyone who walks up to them on the street. There's a real sadness behind that and a real depression. And a lot of times they turn to drugs. A lot of times they turn to, you know, all these different kinds of vices because, you know, you're putting on a mask and doing that for the entirety of your day when you're out in the public. And then when you come home, it's like, I was just at a movie premiere where thousands of people were screaming my name and cheering for me. And then I go back to a hotel by myself and I sit in silence. And like the juxtaposition of that is just like startling, right?
Yeah.
So it's, I really like Will Smith. And even so, when I was watching this Best Shape of My Life series on YouTube, I felt bad for him. I felt like, oh, he's kind of got like a mean streak in him. Mm-hmm. And it's, he was deliberate about showing a side of him that he has been hiding. And and the pressure of hiding that from the public for so long has been eating away at him. And he just kind of like opened himself up to say, this is me. And I've got to be okay with people accepting that this is me. And like one of the stories. So if you don't know, Best Shape of My Life is a series about how he had vowed to lose, like he gained a whole bunch of weight to play Venus and Serena Williams' father in the movie King Richard. So he got out of shape and he was like, okay, well, I'm going to have a documentary crew film me as I work really hard to get back to my regular shape. And in his 50s and all of his, you know, travel and everything like that, it's difficult and stuff like that. But what it became was like a fight against his public persona and his personal life and that struggle, like maintaining the two. And one of the things that it's really interesting and it really gets deep, you know? But he talks about this kind of turning point where those two came to a head. And he said, you know what? I need to protect my mental health. I need to know when to say when and set healthy boundaries. And as someone who, anyone wants a selfie, anyone wants an autograph or a video or anything like that, he would accommodate them. So he was promoting a movie. He was in another country and he's like, man, I'm just feeling out of it. I don't feel good. I need to get away from this red carpet. I need to go work out. So he got access to like a private gym or something like that. And he's just working out. And then this guy comes up to him and says, yo, Will, my little brother, he's special needs. He just loves Will. He just loves
you. That's in the book too.
Yeah. It's in the book too. Yeah. Oh, thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate it. I'm working out right now. He's like, yo, let's do a video together and send it to him. It will just make his day. And he goes, no, thanks, man. I'm good. And prior to, you know, like he would never turn something like this down before, but he said, I'm going to set a boundary and I'm going to stick to it, and I have to for my own mental health. And then the guy was like, no, come on, Will. It'll just take a second. He goes, man, I don't want to do this. And the guy was like really flustered. He walked away. He finished his workout. And then Will went back to his hotel room and cried because he had done that. It's like, on one hand, it's something he really, really needed to do for himself. But at the cost of everything he's built, this persona, this like, oh, he's the Will Smith that you see on TV, and what you see is what you get. And it's, you know, that was really hard for him. So it's a really interesting, like, deep dive into the real Will Smith, which I really appreciated seeing because, you know, as I've said before, my first album was He's the DJ, I'm the Rapper. And I became familiar with him, you know, as Fresh Prince. And then when the show came out, I was like, hey, that's that dude that I, you know, that I've been listening to for the past couple of years. Really liked that. And then, you know, Men in Black and Independence Day and everything after that. It's just, you know, I've been a real fan of. So it was really interesting to see him be that vulnerable in a way that you don't see the biggest movie stars or the biggest celebrities, you know. So I highly recommend checking that out. He brings his family in and he talks to them. It's really interesting because part of his book was like, I don't want anybody in my life to be surprised at what I'm writing in here. So I'm going to meet with each of them and read them the parts that are about them so that it's all out there. You want me to, you know, give me notes, you know, if there's something you're not comfortable with. But by and large, he put a lot of stuff in there that was like pretty startling, right? And he had his ex-wife in there, he had his kids in there, and he's reading parts about them to them. And it shows their faces and they're crying, they got tears and stuff. It was just a really deeply vulnerable series. And it was crazy to watch. Just really interesting.
Let's grab a tie into the book because you touched on it there. In the book, he talks about going through this, that he's buried the real Will under personas. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he, has what seems to be a great relationship with his therapist to work through a lot of these things. And they name the personas, and the two main ones there that kind of protect or make decisions for Will, to let Will sit in a back chair in his head, are I think it's Uncle Fluffy is the persona that wants to please everyone, and it's what formed his entertainment career. And it's born out of the childhood trauma of his father abusing his mother, and his response was, if I can please people, if I can entertain people, it's that wants to make everyone happy, and that persona, I would say, is the dominant like persona that comes to shape the public persona of who Will Smith is,
right?
And then the other persona that kind of seems to be when Will needs to be protected or things just need to get done is the persona of the general. And so that part that's again influenced by his father, but more on like taking the endearing parts of his father. I think it was fueled also by the boxing trainer that he had during Ali that then became a part of his regular crew until he decided to like just F off with the general attitude when he was on the set with Jaden in Pursuit of Happiness, that he chose his kid's happiness over the relentless pursuit of excellence.
Yeah. I think it was After Earth, that second movie they did when he was a little bit older. Okay. I think so. But
So, but like, I think that like then like those things, like to tie, you know, my rough theme here was fluid versus rigid values. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that like values change necessarily over time, but you can, not that you pick your values, but the value that he established was one where the focal point allowed many different vehicles and different iterations. He's fixated. Like, he is not an unfocused person. Yeah. But because he values making people happy, he values making sure people are entertained. And it's born out of that childhood trauma, right? Yeah. And you mentioned Robin Williams, I think, was anchored by a similar thing. A lot of entertainers are anchored by that thing.
Yeah.
And when you value things like this, that the vehicle to get to achievement is, it can be fluid. It creates a lot of mobility, and it creates a lot of like ability to pursue things in different ways. And you don't, you have the ability to become different iterations of yourself and your craft. There's a lot of room for growth, right? But with that also, there's an inherent emptiness to it because it is perpetual. There is no, you have to appreciate that it is a process that you enjoy. If you think that you're getting to a destination, you're going to turn into Will Smith at a certain point of his life where his box office numbers break records and he's not satisfied with it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the story was his producing partner, Benny Medina, called him, and this was what was the one where he was like the last man on earth or something like that. I forget the name of it. But it's an apocalyptic movie, and it's like only Will Smith in it for
is it I Am Legend? Most of it.
I Am Legend. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. I am. So he had this streak of movies that set box office records every single time, like, and every time he's breaking his own record. And then mm-hmm. I Am Legend comes out, and then Benny Medina calls him up and says, "Hey, Will, we did it. $80 million. Biggest opening weekend for a December movie ever." And Will said, "Yo, why do you think we didn't hit 90? Right. And he hung up on him, right? And it's like, he couldn't even enjoy that, right? He mm-hmm. had to like beat this artificial number that he came up with in his head, because he was hitting the marks and it still wasn't providing that happiness. So it's like, well, maybe if it was this much more, I'd be happy, you know? And it's right. It's not happening. And finding that happiness has to come from within and not from the success of your project. Not for the one of the interesting things that he talked about was when he realized that he and Jada could not rely on each other for happiness. I'm pretending I'm Will Smith. Will's happiness can't be derived from another person. They can mm-hmm. make you happy, you know, you can enjoy being with them and whatnot, but it still has to come from within. You know, if you're not happy, it doesn't matter who you're with, you're not going to be happy. And that was kind of like a big revelation, right?
That one's right on the nose too, because I mean the things with Jada are directly related to his childhood trauma. The Uncle Fluffy wanting to entertain everybody thing drove everything else, right? But with his relationship with Jada, what he had to confront is that this persona that he had built to protect himself in his early days and make, like, he came up with the delusion that he could make his dad happy, that he could make his mom happy, that he could make people around him, he could fix things.
No, well, not only make them happy, but protect them because, yes. And you know, and he talks about he watched his dad hit his mom so hard that she passed out, and he thought in that moment, when I'm keeping Daddy-O laughing, he's not hitting, he's not hurting, and stuff like that. So he felt a failure to protect his mom in that moment. And decided that for the rest of his life, he is going to protect all of the women in his life, whether they need it or not, whether they want it or not, whether it's warranted or not. But he was going to do that. And entertainment meant protection. If you, and then he even translated that to being an African-American man in, you know, being the only African American in a setting where it's, you know, he's in a school full of, you know, that's predominantly Caucasian and stuff like that. If he's making them laugh, he's not being targeted, you know, like racially motivated and stuff like that. So like that carried through, which is a really, really interesting thread that kind of weaves throughout his life, his career. It's really, I don't know. I felt moved by that and I felt that.
Me too. It was important for me to hear. Like I feel like I'm on a rather, front end part of untangling some similar things.
Yeah.
And so it was helpful for me not to hear that, not as an awakening, because it wasn't just an awakening, it was a resonance of with my relationships. The way that I've sunk my failed relationships is trying to be all about that person.
Yeah.
And that person's happiness and safety is my responsibility.
Yeah.
And I get to inferring what nonverbals mean. I feel like I need to spend every moment with that person, like that person needs to be fulfilled by me.
Yeah.
And I have found I've found a lot of the same things that Will has, that's a drain on both people, and that people aren't unions. People are individuals. And when you lose your identity, you lose everything. And you can't be happy if you're not sitting with yourself, right? If you're constantly out there being about everyone else, and no one's, it's like capture the flag, right? If no one's guarding the flag, it's gone. It was important for me to hear that.
Absolutely. And almost like a, not like you said, not a revelation, but maybe a template and holding up a mirror to saying like, yeah, I do that, or I've done that and had similar feelings and reactions and stuff, you know? So that's I want to transition real quick to abuse.
Yeah.
The awkward transition.
Yeah.
That's what that's for. But I think it's really poignant. And I think this is one of the tent poles that you were talking about in the beginning. And I'm going to try to do my best to encapsulate it. But he talks about his dad's abuse of his mother, abuse of the children, physical abuse, emotional abuse. Yet he loves him. Yeah, I think he said something like, my father has been both my greatest source of pain and also love. And it is very easy to say he's a piece of shit and he is an abuser and everything like that. But talking about the depth of people and talking about how you can love a deeply flawed person. A deeply flawed person can also have a positive impact on your life. And that's something that that's really difficult to grasp, right? Because in order to protect ourselves, we say, I'm not, that person is dead to me. I'm not going to engage with that person anymore. I'm only speaking with, you know, from my own personal experience and saying, like, I don't want to engage with that anymore, right? And he, for the first time as I'm hearing this, he made it not weird to me that he still had a relationship with his father. And it's, I think it was kind of difficult to grasp until he talked about it and talked about his death. And, like, you know, I think he said after his death, it freed him to talk about the things that he had been hiding for, you know, forever, right? But man, that was really powerful to me. For him to say he was the greatest source of love in my life and also the greatest source of pain, which that's a statement, man. That is, I've never heard that before.
What's your experience with abuse? Do you have?
It's not, you know, I haven't, I have to be honest, I haven't experienced that personally, but I was kind of, parlaying that thought into, not wanting to be around toxic people and not wanting to, you know, if someone is a racist person, I don't want anything to do with them. If someone is, you know, if their values don't align to mine, you know, screw them. I'm not gonna bend over backwards to keep them in my life. And so that, I think I've maybe been in the past quick to do that. And then thinking, well, Will went through this very traumatic experience with his, you know, upbringing and stuff like that. But he was still able to honor him and and appreciate him despite of that, right? So it's not a one-to-one apples to apples kind of thing, but it was impactful to me in that I could recognize that and maybe apply it to my life. So that's,
yeah,
that's
it. I do think there's a tie-in with, like, his the wanting to please people and then how that formed his values of, like always having the next thing and just, like, the general fluidity that I kind of talk about. I think that Will Smith is a person that morphs and evolves, and how he talks about his father now, if you could have heard him talk about his father in an earlier part of his life, might be very different. I mean, he talks about relationships different. And I think that's a major thing that I appreciate about the book, is that he doesn't try to editorialize, like, from his vantage point of life now, looking back on past events as if he's not the character there. He really tries to embody and represent to the best of his ability, looking backwards, how he felt at the time. And I think that that's an impactful part of this. Just to touch on it, I had abuse in my home growing up that I wasn't as aware of.
Yeah.
It didn't happen in front of me, at least not during an age where I could recall it.
Yeah.
But I found out in adulthood a lot more of what had happened. And this is the reason why I think I'm not good at picking up on nonverbal cues. Like yeah, I'm not, yeah. I'm a linguistic person. I'm not a very good non-linguistic person. And, that's why like making people happy was such a stupid thing for me to try to do, because, like if I can't tell you what a face means. If you make a face at, me, like, and then I've realized that about myself, like, people infer stuff about me based upon my nonverbals that are way off, because my nonverbal game is awful. But anyway,
yeah. You have resting Jeff face.
I do. People infer things about what I'm thinking that I'm not, because my face does not, I can only infer. Here I go again, inferring about, I don't know what's going on. All I know is that people regularly think I'm upset when I'm thinking. Regularly like think I'm just not happy about stuff because if I show up not talking, because on a regular basis, I'm a talkative person. Right. But I'm also a listener. And when I can turn that on, I tend to be extreme in the ways that I show up in places.
Yeah. Yeah.
I appreciate his story and his, the way that he laid out his father as his greatest source of love and pain.
Yeah.
I believe so much of who I am, good and bad, are characteristics that my father influenced. My father was a huge influence on my life.
Yeah.
And, both in ways that like, and I think it's true with Will, like there's stuff about his father, like the brick by brick kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Like he picked out the positive and wanted to do that. And then the stuff that he thought was flaws of his dad, he went the absolute opposite direction. And that is very much in line about how I've built myself as a person.
Yeah.
Not always intentionally. It's just that's how I am. Now his ability, and like you said, everyone's situation is different. His ability to keep his father in his life is baffling to me.
Yeah.
Because and maybe it's because of when he was forced to make that choice. He was forced to make that choice when he was quite young. He witnessed his mother getting knocked out by his father.
Yeah.
And he did not have the choice to leave the home. And so I think that kind of codifies in you a little bit of like you live with that. The traumas, my mother took, and she told me this, that she took steps to frame my dad in a light that she thought was an appropriate father figure.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah.
And even though she knew that her marriage was over when I was 5 years old, and and I was 20 years old before she left him. Yeah. And so I think that there's different situations there by, and I'm thinking about this now, by deferring my awareness until I was 20, I was able to first off take my time. It wasn't overnight that I made a decision on how my relationship with my father would be going forward. But it also allowed me to have the ability to make that choice as an adult. and without the baggage of like knowing and having to like just integrate it into my childhood. Like it wasn't always, it was a new thing. And I think also the distance from it, it made it so that I can make the choice more rationally, right? Like if you're an investigator picking up a cold case, yeah. You probably don't have the baggage of like, you know, if the original investigator that was there and experienced all the media coverage and the urgency when a person was found dead. So I'll just say, like, I've been estranged from my father for getting close to a decade now, and yeah. it's been a really healthy life choice for me. Because he's a sociopath, because he doesn't care about anyone else. And, you know, it just go in that direction. And as I sit right now, I have no intent to have a future relationship, but I still look back on like going to Red Wing games with him as a kid, mm-hmm. and thinking very fondly of it and telling my kids about, you know, when I was a kid, my dad would take me here and we would do this. And I still do things like my eating choices, right? Like my, the things that I value, the way that I approach conversation. My dad was a very, I mean, he's still alive, but like my dad is very, my dad is very loud. My dad is very talkative. He loves holding court and having that. And I think that these are all good things. And so in a way I'm similar in where I can extract what I like now, like I don't demonize in holistically. I'm not regretful that's my past. I've come to peace with and part of it is my mom has given me permission to like it's okay. Like yeah. that's my past and I made those choices and it wasn't your choice to make and I'm okay now. Like you can feel how you want to feel. Just make sure that, you know, you're making healthy choices for yourself. So I can empathize with that, but my decision, I got to tell you, when he was talking about his dad, like in the final days and forgiving him, it did make me think a little bit about like forgiveness for death is permanent and, yep. and forgiveness is cathartic. And it got me to thinking about, have I forgiven? And even if I don't do it, even if I don't let him know that I've forgiven him, how important it is for me to be at peace with myself.
Yeah.
That I hold that in my heart. Because bitterness, regardless of right or wrong and justifiable bitterness.
Yeah.
Is not something to hold,
right? And well, it hurts you. It doesn't hurt the perpetrator of that against you, right? It hurts you, right? You're the one that it's causing anxiety. You're the one who, you know, is disadvantaged by holding on to that. So, and I don't even know that Will truly forgave his dad. I think he was able to recognize in him some humanity and he chose to have a relationship with him for his own reasons. And that's what worked for him. I don't think that there's any sense maybe I was giving off this, this vibe when I said that earlier, but I want to be clear that I wasn't saying like he is a good person because he forgave. I think for him, it was what he was comfortable with and what he wanted. For you, for anyone else in the world, what you do to preserve your mental state is appropriate and good. So just to be clear on that. But what I do want to say, and you know, thank you for sharing that. I want to say, like, man, what a beautiful, messy existence we all have, right? Because yeah. You can have those things. You can experience that, you know, whether it's you, whether it's Will, whether it's me and things that I've experienced that don't, you know, compare, but we can have those experiences and honor the good in them and recognize what it was that meant something to us and also recognize the other stuff. And that's life. It's messy, but it's sort of like a beautiful chaos, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, sounds like you got a visitor there. Do you want to wrap this up? Do you want to come to the conclusion here?
Yeah.
All right. So let me just cue this little guy up here and say. That just cracks me up. It's like we're on TV or something. Yeah. It's like HTV, HGTV. So I really liked this book as someone who has followed Will Smith for his entire career, from 17-year-old rapper to 52-year-old YouTuber. And I started out the book enjoying the that's okay enjoying the behind the scenes details of all of these events that I'm familiar with as someone who's followed him. But as the book turned toward the portions of him and his life and the reflection that he had and the ways in which he realized, you know, the things that were harming him and things that he had to do to protect himself and his mental health. I got something out of that too. So it started off as being a fanboy. And then at the end, it was kind of like a self-help book and an introspection kind of, hey, what, and relating it to my life, you know, and stuff. So I really liked it. I liked the audiobook especially hearing him swear, because you don't hear him swear too much, right?
It seems like he, like, that's cool. that was, I don't think that was forced either. Like, I don't think he went that direction to just be completely opposite. Like, yeah. his grandmother Gigi really struck a chord with him in like projecting his public persona as it ended up being. And that's an interesting wrinkle too. Like, the amount of swearing that was in there. Like, I think one of the points that kind of took me out of flow of listening to him, sometimes was, both that it sounded like he was reading, like he doesn't have a good fluid, speaking voice. And when I say speaking, I mean like scripted speaking voice, which as an actor, like I would think like his ability to like use tone and inflection, I thought it was lacking. Yeah. I don't know if this is necessarily a negative, but something I noticed is that he uses a lot of unnecessary vocabulary to describe, in my opinion, like, yeah. I feel like he churched the vocabulary up a lot, and maybe that's just the way that he writes and the way that he thinks. And there's not a much edit there, but some of the phrasing just kind of took me out of it. Like what's going on? And so I don't want to infer that he's trying to sound smart or that maybe that's just how it is, but it's not the way I'm used to hearing him talk. And so maybe that's the authentically him part. So that's more of an interesting part. The reading thing, I think, like, the flow could have improved. Sure. I think something that definitely is a plus for the audiobook is you get a little bit of music, like spliced in there. Yeah. And it fits really well.
Sure.
So for me, all the points that you talked about, I think I was probably like the most vivid, like, parts of my brain in following the story were the early stories, probably up in through like the Quincy Jones stuff.
Yep,
it's because they're such fantastic stories.
Yeah.
And then I think he continues it as he's starting to talk about like his self reflect, like looking, because he got more famous after Fresh Prince. And he got more of a jerk and less and more out of touch with what he was. He stopped having much fun and became like this pursuit of excellence person as the movie star. He started like critiquing himself as he was continuing to tell the same level of interesting stories. Like, I found the detail of the Quincy Jones story to be amazing. I mean, like, because it's famous people and just this bizarre behavior of it.
Yeah.
The Nelson Mandela story has all those same ingredients, but it was like his self-critique. And I feel like it minimized, like you could have let that breathe with the detail a little bit more. I don't know if there's not as much detail there as the Quincy Jones story, but like, it's like, whoa, this dude's talking about meeting Nelson Mandela and like having a personal relationship with him, and Nelson Mandela telling him like he wants to spend more time with him and saying that he's an important person. And then the story's over. Like, like, dude, tell a whole book about Mandela. Wait a minute. Like it became like just a passing. Yeah, I met Mandela. I had this conversation with Ali and he did Ali things and and maybe and so. But how I take it, Brandon, like in the whole of everything, is he was painting the picture of his life speeding up. It's like he let it breathe at the start because it was all happening organically and things were new and they were exciting. And then it hit this point where it was boom, boom, boom. Like his epic run became hard for me to follow, and it became disjointed. And then all of a sudden it's like he hits a wall, and then it's turning in like the therapy and the introspection and saying goodbye to his father and it got
over FaceTime.
But all the work he put in before that to where FaceTime didn't feel weird. The level of detail that he tells the story about his father leaving is the same level of detail he's told the story about being in Quincy Jones' office, or when he did his own ad libs, when he did his own rewrites, and he had to go to the exec's office, and he almost ended up like murking this 50, 60-year-old white exec, right? I like this book because of like that implicit speeding up, like slow speeding up, slowing down, and how it mirrors kind of the chaos and the calm of the different phases of his life. So I definitely like, I recommend this book, like if you appreciate like literary structure. Like, I think it's a well-told story.
And it
creates feelings in you that help you to empathize with where he's at. And it also, it's one of the rare books that like tells it, and especially a memoir, because I really dig memoirs in general.
Yeah, me too.
But the risk that you run when you're reading a book by a person that usually you already have a pre-existing interest in liking is that you end up drinking Kool-Aid. Like heavily. And I think he did a good job of like the way that he framed his life. There was stuff I disagreed with. Like I just told, like I would not get, I would his dad, like, punching his mom, I would have taken his brother's approach. Like, he was wrong.
Yep.
I like that he invites, the way that he framed it, he invites you to disagree with him. But he also invites you to listen to it anyway, which is really powerful. So yeah, I like it, man.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm glad that you called attention to that, because I didn't really recognize it at the time. I knew something was going on, but the way that you talked about it, where it's like the phases of his life, it's like his early and the struggle and all of that was like kind of methodical and slow and stuff like that. And then it hits a point like in the early 2000s where he's, you know, he's the Will Smith, and it's like boom, 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 movie, 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 movie. And then all of a sudden we're like, you know, taking peyote in a national park or something. I was like, what's happening? How did we get here? Right.
And that was really detailed again, right? Like he's talking about what he's laying the setting and everything like that. But that middle section is chaos.
It's crazy.
Like, it's so hard to, especially when you're not reading the text and you can't control your own pacing, you're going with him. Like that, but that's part of the experience, right? Like that's how he felt.
Yeah. Well, and I felt it along with him because he is a master storyteller, and we got to experience it in that way by listening to it. So, loved it. Thumbs up. Check it out. So, thank you for listening to us. Talk about. There we go.
you have less hair on your arms. It looks more like it.
I'm a swimmer. I shave them. No, I don't. Anyway, thank you for joining us on this journey. Please check out the book. We both highly recommend it. So, any last words, Jeff?
Nope.
All right. I wish we could do a thing where we both get thrown out of the call like jazz, thrown by Uncle Phil. So again, thank you for watching. I'm Brandon. That's Jeff. We'll talk to you next time. Take it easy.